Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
When people say that gentrification or neighborhood improvement brings jobs and assets to the community for the existing people, really they're just lying. And they're using some select examples of one or two people who might get a job as a dishwasher or sweeping a street. They use these lowest paid, most insecure positions as sick justifications for a social process that displaces hundreds of people.
That's the voice of Ivan Drury, organizer for CCAP, Carnegie Community Action Project, on the downtown east side, Canada's poorest neighborhood. Ivan talks about how the city and developers are using an organized blueprint to gentrify the neighborhood, how residents are fighting back, and more importantly, a lesson for us all in our communities of how we can resist the destruction and displacement of people. So stay tuned. On the phone, I have Ivan Drury. He's an organizer with the Carnegie Community Action Project. Welcome to the show, Ivan.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Now, Ivan, your group has been speaking out loudly as one of many groups against gentrification, specifically a new restaurant, the Pigeon Restaurant, that's being built across from Pigeon Park in the downtown east side, and for most of our listeners will know is one of the poorest areas in British Columbia and Canada for that fact. Let's start at the very basics, because many people don't understand how gentrification works. They feel that bringing investment and bringing new money and jobs, etc., like a restaurant to the neighborhood, is always a good thing. So could you just give us some background on how gentrification works and why you would oppose such a development?
Well, gentrification started out as the word gentrification started out as a joke about the developments that were coming in parts of New York in the 80s. And that word comes from a hybrid of the word gentry and the development of an area from a working class or low income area, an area that's predominantly communities of color or migrant communities, where people are living because the rents are cheap, usually because they don't have a choice. And it's sort of the most undesirable area in a city where higher income, middle class white people don't want to settle and want to push these undesirable communities into these areas. And then there's a transformation that takes place. The city plans to take over those areas with real estate capital and with investment monies again. And so there's a flood of those higher income people and communities into those spaces. And the poor people, the working class people, the communities of color are pushed out. In the downtown east side, this word is far from a joke. It's a serious problem that the community has been grappling with increasing importance for especially since 2009, since the Woodward's building opened. And there's some particular characteristics of gentrification in the downtown east side. They're different than other places. In the downtown east side, gentrification is incredibly engineered. It's always a matter of city policy when there's this level of planning change happens in an area. There's nothing natural, inevitable about gentrification, which is the way that planners and business people always talk about it, that change is inevitable, that every place every city in the world is undergoing pressures of gentrification. In the case of the downtown east side especially, it's really not true, and it's only accomplished because city council gives welfare to the rich in order to take the space back from the poor communities and the low-income indigenous communities that have been living and made homes and made safe spaces in the downtown east side despite all odds for decades.
Gentrification has been going on for decades, and every time something like this happens, the media is just they act so incompetent or so uninformed about how it works, and we have to start this conversation all over again. So let's just stamp it out right here, and so we can move forward with a more healthy conversation. does new developments like the Pigeon Restaurant bring new jobs and prosperity? How does that development affect the area?
So the way that I wanted, I find it most useful to talk about the changes that happen with the introduction or reintroduction of real estate investment and speculation into the downtown east side, which is basically how gentrification is proceeding here from an economic point of view, is to look at the example of the Woodward's building, which the Woodward's building is, if people who don't know the downtown east side well, is about a full block size, formerly department store that closed in 1993 at the same time that the federal government stopped funding social housing. In that period, the downtown east side was kind of at a peak of abandonment by investors and speculators and by capitalists. And there was a really high proportion of boarded up storefronts and empty buildings, and the conditions of buildings that people lived in were very poor. And there was no interest in reclaiming that by anyone, by anyone with money and power. The Woodward's building opened in 2009 as a social experiment. After there were years and years of struggle, and the community demanded the building, and it was really a community victory that there was any social housing or community amenities at all in the Woodward's building. But it was opened with the majority of the units in it were condominiums. And the planners pushed it as the first real occurrence in Vancouver of what they call a social mix theory of development. And a social mix wouldn't bounce in any other kind of framework. You wouldn't say this community is too native, there needs to be some white people here, this community is too Chinese, there needs to be some white people here. But you can say this community is too low income, we need some higher income people here in terms of social acceptability. And so the Woodward's building was 25% of the rooms of the units in the Woodward's building were welfare rate social housing, and the rest of them were higher end condos. And the majority of the shops that were also brought in were heavily subsidized by the city and provincial governments. These shops are also catering towards higher income people, like Nestor's Market and London Drugs, they received 10-year tax holidays from the city in order to open up their businesses there in the Woodward's building because of the social stigma that they had to that the city figured they had to overcome in order to attract these higher end retailers. They all talked about the Woodward's building as an experiment in this social mix, and they said, "In one or two years, let's look back and see whether it worked or not. We wanted to build a space where everyone belongs and where everyone feels comfortable, and with a space for the rich and the poor to get along together." Well, it's been 4 years, and the planners have never done a study of the effect of Woodward's on the area, and the city council has never organized for one to be done. But we, in the Carnegie Action Project, we did a study on it this year, and we looked at the area immediately surrounding Woodward's. And back in the spring last year, we looked at the retail landscape and the storefronts and who they were catering to, and we saw that in 95, before Woodward's opened, that the area was almost entirely catering towards lower income people. Or there was light industrial shops that were there that didn't have a strong that were providing working class jobs, that didn't have a negative impact on the culture of the people who lived in the area and in the street, and that has completely transformed. So almost all of those spaces are now boutique shops and high end retail establishments that employ very few people. And which have a very detrimental cultural effect on the continued existence of the low-income people, because they don't serve the people who lived in the area. They are marketed entirely towards people who live somewhere else. And then later in the year, we did another study on the effect of this development on housing, and we found that in the immediate area surrounding Woodward's and the blocks surrounding Woodward's, all of the hotels that used to rent to low-income people on welfare and pension are now renting to an entirely different class of people. The rents that used to be close to the welfare shelter rate of $375 a month are now renting well over $500 a month. In many cases, like at the Burns Block, which is marketed as a micro loft, the rents are $975 a month for a 10-by-10 room without a bathroom or kitchen. So the cultural change and the economic change marched on really hand in hand and drove out the low-income community, made it an unsafe space, an uncomfortable space, and a completely unaffordable space for the low-income community. So we lost 404 units of privately owned SRO hotels in the block surrounding Woodward's, and there was only only 125 units gained in the social housing component of the project itself. So there was a net deficit of 279 units of low-income affordable housing because of the Woodward's development, and it's directly because of gentrification. When people say that gentrification or neighborhood improvement brings jobs and assets to the community for the existing people, really they're just lying. And they're using some select examples of one or two people who might get a job as a dishwasher or sweeping a street. They use these lowest paid, most insecure positions as sick justifications for a social process that displaces hundreds of people.
You're absolutely right. And I think when we look at what's happening down there, that you could just almost, you know, draw a blueprint as to how to go about manipulating the media. I've heard so many reports in the CBC that just going over the same old things, and they're not having a fresh conversation. So let's talk about that. What do you think, or your group, the Carnegie Action Center, has been in the neighborhood for decades and working with people there. So what should happen there? What would be a healthy shaping of the neighborhood? What would you like to see happen now?
Well, before I was around, Wendy Peterson and Gene Swanson, they did a 2-year study they worked with the Carnegie Action Project. They did a 2-year study for the future of the downtown east side, and produced a report called Vision for Change in the downtown east side, a community vision for change. They did it by interviewing 1,200 low-income residents, people who live in the heart of the community and who should be part of that change and who should be directing that change. And those people didn't say that they want to see shops come in that they can't afford to shop in or eat in. They didn't say they want to see more condos that they can't afford to live in. They said that they want to have more social housing to end homelessness and to develop enough housing that people don't have to live in the crummy SRO hotels anymore, because these rooms are not dignified, decent places to live. They're necessarily unhealthy and unsafe spaces, especially for people who are more vulnerable to violence. Like women in those spaces kind of live in a perpetually violent and dangerous situation. And they said that the most important thing about the community needs to be preserved. And that's something that's hard to explain in the media, or hard for the media to understand, because it's countered constantly by the stigma of that the media itself has produced, and that investors and the government themselves have produced, which is that the downtown east side is a wasteland, a dead area where people are sick and dying, and it's constantly characterized through a very negative lens that dehumanizes the residents. And the story it tells is that those people are not capable of determining their own lives, that they need to be taken care of one way or another, either by prisons or mental health institutions or some other means. But when we talk to the residents say that that's not true, and that they are they're human beings who deserve to determine their own futures, and that the problem that they've had is that they've struggled within institutions for all their lives, and that they need to be freed from that. And the most important thing about the downtown east side, those people say, is the sense of community and belonging in the area. That people who go into the downtown east side often don't feel comfortable in any other space in the city or in the country. There's people there who kind of are refugees from social stigmas because they're indigenous and low income, or because they are HIV positive, or because of their physical disabilities, or their health conditions like addictions. For all of these reasons, people come into the downtown east side and generally arrive in bad shape. But through decades of struggle, those communities of oppressed people have created spaces of hope and belonging and well-being that are unique in the city and even in the country. And if that community is displaced, that well-being and sense of belonging and community for those people who won't feel comfortable anywhere else, all of that will be lost and have to be rebuilt. And we're not sure that there's another space to rebuild that, because the signs are that the effects of displacement from the downtown east side these days are that people are pushed out into permanent rootlessness, that people are moved to Surrey and then to New West and then to South Vancouver and then back to New West and then to a shelter in the downtown east side, and that there's nowhere for people to land and create the kinds of strong community resistance that have been created in the downtown east side. The vision of change that that CAP has worked on within the community is to maintain the downtown east side as a majority low-income community in order to keep that sense of community mutual support and that sense of belonging, and to fight back against the hyper-commodification of the city that occurs in every other part of Vancouver. And to protect that by raising income levels for people on welfare out of the absolutely horribly dismal poverty that they're forced to live in is about $7,000 a year. And to improve the housing that people live in by getting rid of the SROs and building social housing. And by allowing that community to continue to develop its ethics of volunteering and mutual aid that have been built over decades of struggle.
You're quite right about the stereotypes and stigmas that are applied to certain people in certain areas. And by natural extension of those stereotypes is the treatment of the people that, that are being stigmatized. Last time I was down at the Woodworths, I went to an event and I noticed about six or seven security guards within a two-block radius from where I parked into walking over there. And they were specifically targeting people who were trying to come into the courtyard. So much for that inclusivity that the city originally talked about. And then also I was disgusted to find out that that Goldcorp, one of the most unethical corporations in the world, is a big sponsor. It seems to me upside down. You talk about how people are treated by outsiders or security in the area.
So first, I want to acknowledge that the women's organizations in the downtown east side have done an incredible amount of work and advocacy and waged a successful struggle, in not completely successful, but a very important struggle, to have the most stigmatized and dehumanized people in the downtown east side. That means I'm talking about Indigenous women in the downtown east side and Indigenous sex workers, particularly since the tragedy of the murder of missing women has been finally acknowledged in the media and by the government. The advocacy and struggle of these women has produced a couple of things that are important, and one of them is the sex work enforcement protocols that the City Hall passed and with the VPD in the fall of 2012, and those protocols basically say that the way that the police had been dealing with sex workers, it was Indigenous women in the downtown east side, is wrong, and that they should not be treating them as criminals, but that they should be acting as a support, as helping to support them to access peer agencies. And now the new protocols are not perfect. There's still problems insistence on enforcing minor warrants against women who are seeking protection against violent offenders, against predators. But there's a major step forward. Now, the problem with it is that it only applies to the police, and it doesn't apply to the security guards, which are hired by the business improvement associations and are accountable to nobody. And so those security guards are now continuing the same style of enforcement, pushing women out of public spaces and pushing them into alleys and pushing them into spaces where they're more vulnerable to violence. So security guards are people who don't live in the neighborhood and don't receive training and don't have interactions with people except for as their role of protecting private property against the low-income residents who live in those properties for most case and who live around them because they're social spaces or the streets. They're either homeless or they're living in tiny rooms where it's impossible to exist without going out and taking up park spaces and sidewalks as part of your social space. So the relationship between security guards, which are representatives and direct and are hired by, contracted by the businesses, and the low-income community is perpetually one of antagonism. And it puts the most vulnerable members of that low-income community into danger because those security guards push them into break-up groups and push people into isolated positions and continue to perform the dehumanizing of them, which results in them being picked off by serial killers and to be constantly abused by people with power. It's a hostile relationship between the low-income community and those outside because of this incredible social stigma, and because there's this because of gentrification, because the city and the businesses are trying to take over the streets and take over the storefronts as places to sell goods and not for low-income people to be. know, that people, of course, don't have money to spend in those stores.
How is it materializing with the authorities on the streets at this time? Is it getting better or worse?
Right. So it is. There is an increasing problem with security guards directly targeting women and drug users on the street and pushing them off and treating them as though they have the security guards or the power to do that, which they don't. But because people believe they do, they have a kind of a de facto power. And that's one hand. And on the other hand, the police are in every other area. There's some spots where there's been some struggle and improvement. But in every other area, we see an increasing harassment of low-income community members on the street by police. And it's done by the enforcement of civic bylaws against low-income people. There was a study that was released in the media done by the Pivot Legal Society just last week that showed that more than 96% of the bylaw tickets that are handed out in the city of Vancouver are handed out in the downtown east side, that there is almost no bylaw enforcement done in any other part of the city. But people in the downtown east side are visited with thousands of bylaw infractions tickets. And this has always been, there's always been strong anecdotal evidence for this in the community, because everybody has tickets for selling goods on the sidewalk, for spitting, for jaywalking, for riding a bicycle without a helmet. And the police use these bylaw infractions as reasons to pull people over and shake them down, go through everything they own, harass them, and to give them tickets. And because people don't have the ability to pay these tickets, because the tickets are like $250, $300 tickets, people pile up the tickets and then go to jail for failure to pay tickets. And then they go to jail again for failure to appear on their minor court cases around these tickets. And it's a way of criminalizing low-income people for just being in public space and for imprisoning them for that and for actually physically removing them from those public spaces through the police forces. And we're seeing a similar thing starting now with enforcement, over-enforcement of SkyTrain and bus tickets, with policing, with more and more SkyTrain police and transit police there, specifically in order to target and ticket low-income people. And this will result in people being imprisoned as well. So the problem of this is that low-income people in the downtown east side are unable to stay in the public spaces of their community themselves because of these police harassments, and in order to defend and extend the gentrified spaces and the spaces where low-income people don't feel comfortable. And they're also unable to move around the city because they can't pay the increasing transit fares, and they're getting ticketed for taking a ride on the bus or on the SkyTrain in order to get to places they need to be. So low-income people are becoming a completely alien presence within the city that is catering only towards people with money, and people who pass as consumers in Vancouver. The battle against gentrification is really fundamentally one of belonging, and an insistence that it's human beings who get to stay in a city, it's human beings who make up communities, and it's not just the exchange of money that determines the value or worth of people or neighborhoods.
It is a battle, and the way I see it, it's a simple battle between the people who live and dwell and have roots in the neighborhood, who want to have some direction as to what kind of community, what kind of neighborhood they have to live in, and those folks who see that land as lucrative and want to push people out of the area. So I commend you for your work, but I will ask you if there's a way that listeners can find out more and get involved.
Well, now is really a time for people throughout the city and throughout the province to get involved in the struggles against displacement and for social housing and income justice and to fight back against the agendas of the governments in the city and in the province and the Harper regime, because it's a provincial election coming up. So the Carnegie Action Projects, we're part of a coalition called Social Housing Coalition BC, and this coalition's fighting for social housing to be on the agenda in the provincial election, which is coming up in the middle of May. And we encourage people to get involved. We're doing flying squads at Liberal and NDP party events. And we're doing every Saturday from 12 to 1 stands for social housing on street corners throughout the province. There's close to 20 places around the province that there's 1 hour stands for housing every week on street corners. We'll be having a major day of action coming up in May or in late April. So check out our website, which is socialhousingbc.com. And you can also look up resources about gentrification on the CAP website, which is CCAT Vancouver.
www.wordpress.com, and you can read our report on the affordable housing situation in the Downtown East Side and gentrification of the Downtown East Side from 2012, which is, you can find it there, and that report is called We're Trying to Get Rid of the Welfare People. So read more and learn more about what's going on, and please plug in with this coalition, which is on social housing in these next upcoming months, and let's fight for change here in the province.
Thanks again, Ivan, for joining us. And I do encourage our listeners to get involved, because they're civil servants. We're electing them, and we should have a say also in how we want our money used. And I would like my money used in a more human way. And thanks again for doing this.
Thank you very much.
Bye for now.
I'm going to finish the show with We Are Everywhere by David Horowitz. Take care.
I say the hungry should have food. I speak for many when I say no one should have seven homes. While some don't have any, though I may find myself stranded in some strange place with naught but a vapid stare, I remember the world and I know. We are everywhere. When I say the time for the rich, it will come. Let me count the ways, victories or hints of the future. Havana, Caracas, Chiapas, Buenos Aires. How many people are wanting and waiting and fighting for their share? They hide in their ivory towers, but we are everywhere. Religions and prisons and races, borders and nations, FBI agents and congressmen and corporate radio stations. They try to keep us apart, but we find each other, and the rulers are always aware that they're a tiny minority, and we are everywhere. Every bomb that they drop, every home they destroy, every land they invade, comes a new generation from under the rubble saying, we are not afraid. They will pretend we are few, but with each child that a billion mothers bear, comes the next demonstration. We are everywhere. We are everywhere. We are everywhere.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the US. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.